My first note for this song is this a fucking joke? That was my first note. This song is so bad.
Hello and welcome to another episode of 1001 Album Complaints, the show where longtime friends and musicians, music critics, and otherwise get together to discuss a classic album as chronicled in the list of 1001 albums you must hear before you die. We'll get you up to speed on the history of the band that we'll talk about today, you know, how the record was made, all the legacy and historical context, and then we'll vote on whether or not this actually belongs on the list. As you've most certainly noticed, the word complaints is in the name of this actual podcast.
No, I don't believe it.
You know, unless you're the kind of person that just opens up podcasts without reading the names, you know we're going to do some complaining. But rest assured, we are musicians ourselves. We know what it's like to write and record music. And so we go about this with the utmost appreciation for the craft in mind. But hey, there's some funny shit, especially on this album, to talk about. So that's what we are going to do today.
Oh, yeah.
So with that out of the way, I'm actually really excited to dive into this week's group, which was a pretty revolutionary entertainment collective that spawned a ton of superstars. Like, I'm talking Jamie Foxx, Damon Wayans, Jim Carrey, and even J-Lo. Oh, wait, this is Living Color, not In Living Color.
Although there was a lawsuit at one point, but anyway.
You can do what you want to do.
In Living Color. Yeah. Great show, by the way. I, for the longest time, could never figure out, get them all straight in my mind. But anyway, of course, we're talking about the band Living Color and their debut album called Vivid. Now, if you've never listened to a note of rock radio or MTV in your life, well, let's give you a taste of a little known track that's called Cult of Personality.
What's the song called again?
Okay, all right. We'll sink our teeth into this, but for starters, let's go ahead and introduce our esteemed panel here today by way of a tweet-length review of the album Vivid. Let's start with you, Tom.
All right, thank you, everybody. This is Tom. When I first put this album on, I thought it sucked. End of tweet. I do have an alternate tweet if we want to throw it in there.
Yeah, there's only three of us here. Yeah, Let's hear it. Yeah.
It is fitting that Corey Glover played Francis in Platoon because listening to this album 20 times is my own personal Vietnam.
For those of you not, obviously you can't see us on screen if you're listening to the podcast, but Alan almost did a spit take with his water bottle as Tom said that. So well done.
His water bottle.
I wouldn't have done that with beer.
Right, yes.
I'm not wasting an precious, ounce of that.
Precious.
All right, let's turn it to Adam.
Hey everybody, this is Adam. And about Living Color's debut album, Vivid, my tweet is, over-singing, over-playing, overrated. The only over this album wasn't was Soon Enough.
Oh!
Okay, all right. We're coalescing here. I like it. I'm Alan here, and my tweet is, a group of black virtuoso hard rock slash metal musicians storms the gates of the all-white boys club of the late 80s rock scene, rips the door off his hinges, seizes control of the room, and it just kind of hangs around and does nothing for a little while. But goddamn, was the entrance impressive, though. Okay, I think you probably already get a sense of what we're after here. People probably know this band for many different reasons that we'll all get into. I want to first dive into some of these impressions a little bit and just go a little bit deeper on, you know, how your week was, kind of getting reoriented. I don't even want to say to this album, because I certainly never listened to this album other than, you know, the one or two MTV videos that were made. But curious, initial impressions overall of Vivid.
It's just disappointing. They're really good players. They honestly all can shred at their instruments, and Corey Glover's got a great voice. He can wail. And the album's recorded well. I think that they did a really good job getting good recording fidelity of the instruments. It doesn't sound under-recorded. But, man, it just didn't come together. The song structures and the actual bedrock of the songs is just pretty weak overall. I was not impressed. And then they'll do a shreddy thing, and I'm like, oh, God, you're so good. Why are you playing music that's so bland?
Yeah. This was my first time listening to this album. Again, I've heard Cult of Personality 10,000 times. It's one of those songs where you could probably mouth the guitar solo to if you could make the notes quick enough. But I came out real hot in the tweet. And the truth is, yes, I was disappointed. I didn't hate this album. It was just kind of okay. And I actually think, and we'll probably get into it a bit more, but I've got a couple thoughts here, which is, I think the back half of the album is better, mainly because it's simpler. I think these guys shine when they don't hold true to their prog and their metal roots. I feel like when they embrace that vision or that version of themselves, that's when it goes off the rails. But when things get a little simpler and you've got some straight ahead chord patterns and maybe a more melodic guitar, the songs speak a bit more. So yeah, for me, it wasn't that I hated the album. I just was really underwhelmed that it was even on the 1001 albums you must hear before you die.
See, Adam, I felt kind of the opposite. I agree that the second half of the album is stronger than the first half. I wanted them to go deeper into the prog roots. I wanted them to go like, okay, because I know that they have it in them in terms of just their raw talent to get weird and angular and really go for that sound. And I felt that at their worst, they were just middle of the road. And middle of the road is not bad, but middle of the road is not good.
Right.
Middle of the road, I think, can sometimes be worse. And I think if I'm sensing what the frustration was, at least for me anyway, was that I'm going to make a comparison, and I'm not comparing Living Color to these bands, but just for the sake of comparison, it used to really bother me a lot when I'd hear bad bands that made bad music. But ultimately, I sort of came around to this idea that, like, look, you can't blame Creed for being Creed. You can't blame Kid Rock for being Kid Rock. That's true.
Kid Rock is a product, yes. But anyway, yeah.
But you sort of are who you are, right? What I do get irritated by is exactly what we're saying, which is when top-notch musicians, like, objectively speaking, we'll get into kind of how they came together and what their reputation was on that scene. But I think, objectively speaking, these are some pretty boss musicians. And the frustrating part is exactly what you said, when it's the expectation setting is just a little bit higher. And I know I say this all the time, but I love the opportunity to go back into some of these bands and records that I really only know from a fleeting sort of image on MTV as like a 9-year-old on a Saturday morning watching it, only to find that there is a reason you haven't heard that much about them, because there's just not much there to kind of hang your hat on. I am very tempted to also rip the bejesus out of some of the music on here, and we'll do that. But I also want to like hold these two different ideas in my mind, and they're not like mutually exclusive, which is, they do have historical significance, but I do think equally true in my mind is it's just not an amazing album. I will say, though, in general, I kept coming back to some themes in going through this album that just kept sticking with me. And really, it comes down to, for me, duality, you know, dissonance, tension, and conflict. Not conflict amongst the band, because they actually were pretty, like, mellow dudes mm-hmm. having shit together. And for me, it showed itself in a few areas. I think the first is, these guys were an all-black band of rock, metal, sort of fusion-y guys who were breaking into an extremely white-dominated music scene.
Sure.
The mid to late 80s, you know, their contemporaries were literally Winger, Poison, Rat,
right.
Guns N' Roses. And so that made a lot of people uncomfortable, which is kind of weird. Rock music is inherently black music.
Right.
But
right.
along the way, especially in the 80s, it really became something entirely different. It
became party music. And rock music previously had been protest music, and then it kind of turned into a little bit of like sex music, and then it just went full on no content, just about good times, going down to Panama and, you know, getting girls and all that stuff. And it really got away from its roots of, you know, it kind of started out as like protest music basically, and it had a lot more substance to it. And so we talk about this concept, I don't know, we talk about this concept, but it's a very well-known concept that, especially for black men, there's like a level of excellence that is demanded that is not demanded of an average white guy in many fields, music being one of them. And so I think that that's a big part of where my disappointment came from, because these guys are killer musicians.
Right.
And Vernon Reid and Muzz Skillings, they play together very well. And when they're doing runs together, it sounds
tight.
Great.
Yeah.
And yet, yeah. Winger couldn't do that. Winger wasn't doing right. that.
Well, you haven't heard their deep cuts then.
Oh, yeah. I haven't even heard the Winger shallow cuts. Like,
I can't name a single Winger song.
I only know Winger because of Beavis and Butthead, the kid who had the Winger shirt on. Stewart, right? Yeah. Stewart, yeah.
Cue the angry emails coming in. You guys don't know Winger?
Yeah.
All right, we'll throw it on the list.
If we anger the Winger fans, we're doing something right.
I don't know if you want to pluralize. Yeah. Winger fan.
Right. Fan. Singular.
Yeah. For me, it just came down to, I was excited and then I was just let down. And maybe that's me having outsized expectations unnecessarily, but it didn't really come together for me.
That's pretty consistent from my perspective as well. And their whole story is like rooted in this idea of trying to be something that either they're not or that people expect them to be, but they don't want to be. That actually ended up becoming like a huge obstacle for them, because it's all they were ever asked about.
Right.
Every interview.
What's it like being the only black band in this tour or whatever? Right, right.
And so I think it might be helpful to go back and talk about how they came together. Well, let me first just state a few facts about the album just to be on record there. This was their debut album, released May 2nd, 1988 on Epic Records. It was produced by Ed Stasium, who worked with bands like Talking Heads, Ramones, Motorhead, among others. A smaller producing credit on this, however, went to none other than Mick Jagger, who, to say he played a major role in launching their career might be underselling it. Not in a sense of, I'm not saying they couldn't hold their own. They're obviously sick musicians, but
totally opened the door.
Okay. And again, back to this duality thing, in some ways better or worse, because they felt like, well, why do we need Mick Jagger? Like, we can make it on our own merits. But meanwhile, you had, you know, a part of the population anyway that kind of thought of them as, oh, you just know people.
Right.
They had Mick Jagger. Apparently Kurt Loder was a big advocate, which is why they got so much run on MTV, which we'll talk about.
It's like a no-win situation. You know what I mean? Where it's like, you made it big. Okay, because you're novelty? No. Well, is it because you're great? Yes. But then Mick Jagger, but then you're always fighting that whole like, well, you were pushed here. God, that's rough, man.
Well, and frankly, if you go back and look into the backstory of any of these big bands, they all fucking know somebody.
Yeah,
everybody knows somebody to give them a leg up. It's very, very rare that it was just entirely an organic thing and all the chips were stacked against you and you just happened to excel. Because maybe it's just you knew some club promoters in New York who happened to know some guys who wrote for the New York papers or something. But everybody knows somebody. Not everybody knows Mick Jagger, but everybody knows fucking somebody.
In the Gary Numan episode, one of the aspects of his stories is that he had Asperger's. So he was very regimented in certain things about his life. And so he basically engineered his own success. So like he was at home writing down like where and when the gig needed to be, which newspapers to invite, which record producers to invite to make sure these two ran into each other. So there's a lot of this that's not luck. There's a lot of it that's, it was either Bob Hope or Johnny Carson that said his success was right place, right time, but he always made sure he was in the right place at the right time. So yeah, cuddling up to Mick Jagger, go for it, man. If that's what you need to do to get your foot in the door, I would have done the same.
I would cuddle up to fucking Kid Rock. If right. Kid Rock was like, hey, man, listen, I can launch your career here. I'd be like, oh, dude, did I ever tell you how much I love Cowboy? How great of a song that was?
I'm already clipping that sound clip to blackmail you with for the rest of your life.
Listen, man, if he comes up with a dump truck full of money, I'm not made of stone.
I am but a man.
Nobody in their right mind in the New York club scene where Mick Jagger was hanging out at the time is going to turn down his help. If he wants to help you, you are going to take it. But yeah, to your point, it did put them in a bit of an impossible situation. You know, kind of going back to that scene a little bit, it's clear these guys were very much a product of the times they came in. If you go back to like the early to mid 80s, it seems kind of hard to believe now. I know we're old, but it doesn't seem like that long ago. But, you know, MTV was starting to take off at that time and was obviously becoming like the dominant music medium of the day. But if you watched, you didn't see any black people on MTV, and you certainly didn't see them playing rock music, and you certainly didn't see them earlier than 10 o'clock at night.
I think it's also important context to that, and this actually came up on our Thriller episode, was that MTV was very hesitant to play what they considered not rock music. And rock was, as we're saying, like exclusively white at the time. Certainly popular rock music was exclusively white at the time. And so that sort of led to that. I don't necessarily think that there was a bunch of people sitting around a boardroom saying, like, we can't have black people on MTV. I think that they were like, we're rock music. That's where the money is. And so we're going to play rock music. And so black rock band like Living Color comes around. MTV should be like, hey, this is exactly in our paradigm of what we want to play. And we want to get some diversity. It should be like a win-win. And again, it's not Living Color's fault that MTV would grasp onto that and be like, hey, we should play the shit out of their album.
Right.
You know, interestingly enough, as this was all sort of going on in the early to mid 80s, kind of in the background, you had this virtuoso black guitar player named Vernon Reed, who was at that point pretty well known in the club circuit in New York. Again, this like duality. So he was known as like a jazz fusion player, but he also was kind of a punk rock guy and was doing a lot of weird experimental stuff, like he totally unclassifiable, but badass. So Vernon Reed, he was born in UK, hence the British stylized color.
Color, L-O-U-R, right.
Which I guess is a nod to the year and a half he lived there when he was a baby. I'm not sure. or just to fuck with everybody. But he's sort of like cutting his teeth in this music scene. And, you know, sort of around 83, 84, he decides he wants to start doing his own thing instead of being a sideman or being part of these different groups. So he starts a group that I think at the time he was calling Vernon Reed's Living Color, which then he obviously shortened to Living Color. But it was this sort of like rotating ensemble of the jazz players, but it was very avant-garde and nothing that would even approximate something that you might even hear on this album later on MTV. And so he becomes like pretty well known in New York, was building lots of community with other musicians, but he just wasn't able to break through that bubble and get signed. You know, record companies wouldn't touch them at that point, honestly. And it was sort of the classic too black for rock audiences, but too rock for black audiences. And
too fusion for any audience.
Yeah, they're like, oh, my avant-garde jazz fusion band's not getting this record deal. It's like, right. It's because nobody listens to that shit. I'm sorry. Like,
yeah, I think it was really hard to put anything that Vernon Reed was doing at any point into one specific genre, which actually leads to our favorite segment of the show, which is a segment called By the Numbers. I'll start with the number 12, which is, according to the Wikipedia page for, I think it's for this album, can't remember if it's for the band itself, but 12 is the number of genres that this album crosses, according to Wikipedia. So just, musically,
which is too many. That's just too many.
Oh God!
I'm gonna name them. So let's just buckle in here for a second. So Vivid has been described as hard rock, heavy metal, funk metal, alternative metal, funk rock, with elements of soul, jazz, pop, rap, arena rock, punk, and avant-garde jazz. Let me just say that thank God nu metal hadn't been coined as a term, because it definitely would have been thrown onto this group.
Yeah, seriously.
Too much guitar work for nu metal.
Yeah, there's guitar solos and stuff.
They would have kicked them out of the nu metal scene. Solos? Get the hell out of here.
Not enough guttural screaming?
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, Corey Glover sounds too happy most of the time. Even when he's angry about stuff and like the open letter to a landlord, he still is kind of like, we're empowered. You can't keep us down. As opposed to, fuck you, Dad.
Right.
Backing down a little bit from the number 12, let's go with number 10, which is, and we've seen this a few times on the pod over the episodes here, but these sort of slow burns. 10 is the number of months that this album sat on record shelves, basically doing nothing, until MTV started playing Cult of Personality extensively, which ultimately, you know, propelled this into being in the Billboard Top 20 and spawning to the number one, which is the next one I want to talk about, is the number of Grammys that this album won, which was Best Hard Rock Performance in 1990 for, of course, Cult of Personality.
I thought it was for Funny Vibe.
Another one, which was interesting to hang on to that number for a little bit, the number of covers on this record, which is actually a Talking Heads song called Memories Can't Wait, which is a really cool song. I do think they actually did a pretty nice job with that song, but why a Talking Heads, unclear to me, but
they needed another genre. They needed to, I don't know if Talking Heads are their own genre, but
I liked that cover of the song. I will admit that it took me longer than it should have to realize that it was a Talking Heads cover, partly just because I think I was getting beaten down by the album by the time I got, you know, seven tracks in. I was just like, oh God, we're doing this again. All right, yeah.
The 15th time through, it's a little bit of a workout there.
I think the silver lining for them is that they probably don't give a shit what we think, because the final number is 2 million, which of course is the number of albums that have sold.
Wow.
Bringing it to double platinum status. If you get double platinum, definitely did something right. So, you know, props to these guys for that.
Definitely.
And speaking of props, props to all of you who continue to tune in to the show. We love doing this. It's the best part of the week for all of us, I'm sure. Maybe not Tom when he has to listen to albums like this, but we love having you all on the journey, and we're doing our best to find new ways to connect with you all each week. You know, we're doing that through various forums like newsletters and Patreon. We actually just spawned a new show, a bit of a spinoff show that is 90s rap battles, which is an excellent deep dive. If you want to see us fight with each other even more than we do now, I highly recommend checking that out.
We just get in a group and just diss each other, right? Just dissing each other. You're, of course, referring to our 80, best song of the 80s song battle, right? We already did the best song of the 90s. That's been out for a while. And then now we're doing March Madness, best song of the 80s.
Yes.
You said 90s rap battle, and I was like, holy shit, did I miss a taping? Because that sounds fucking awesome. Like,
Tom, you would have crushed it.
It's just because it's all diss tracks against you, so we couldn't invite you to that yeah. taping.
That's okay. Dude, I have got hours and hours of diss tracks for all of you guys. Cutting up old beats in my spare time.
And all the stupid shit we've said on this podcast.
Alan, I literally do have a diss track for you that I have recorded. I was going to use it in the Fantasy Football League, and it didn't. I wasn't able to use it, but yes.
I'm surprised you only have one, actually. That's
I'm talking fully produced. Like, it's all the way produced. The whole song's
done. It's ready to go. You just need to press it. You're good.
I'll send you the MP3 later.
That might be some bonus content. So, folks, if you follow...
I was going to say, that's some Patreon content right there.
Hit up the Patreon. You never know what kind of nonsense will spring up. But again, thank you. Like, subscribe, all that stuff. We love doing this and want to continue listening to these mediocre albums for your benefit. So Vernon Reid's doing his thing, and he's got this collective rotating members. And finally, in around 86, he coalesces around four core members of the band. But you've got Vernon Reid on guitar. As vocalist, you've got this guy, Corey Glover, who played a small role in the movie Platoon.
I actually really like that character in Platoon. He's one of my favorite guys because he's the one who, like, when the shit starts going down, he's always like, yeah, let's just get the fuck out of here. Why are we sticking around? Let's Dee Dee, man. Let's Dee Dee. Let's get the fuck out of here. I'm like, I'm with you, man. Why are you sticking around? Get the fuck out of there. Nobody cares.
Like, we can just leave?
Yeah. That's an option?
Yeah. No one's going to recognize me in Vietnam. Rounded out by drummer Will Calhoun, who was he graduated with honors from the Berklee College of Music. I find that most impressive, not because of the with honors part, but I've never heard of anyone actually graduating from Berklee. It seems like the kind of place you go and
you only go there for 1 or 2 years and then you leave.
I know, right? Several people who graduated from Berklee and they all work at Guitar Center. I'm not joking about that. I actually know 3 people who graduated from Berklee. They all work at Guitar Center.
And then finally, he didn't discuss his status as the newest entry into the 1001 Album Complaints Hilarious Name Hall of Fame, which is bassist Muzz Skillings. So amazing name.
Yes, Muzz.
Also, fun fact about him, by the time that he got pulled into this project in 86, he was really close to becoming a full-time firefighter.
Really?
Which is crazy because he is a great bassist. Again, it doesn't always fit what's happening in the song, but I mean, the chops for days.
Yeah.
Can we talk for just 1 second? And this was in a Corey Glover interview, found out about how he joined the band, which I thought was like really interesting, that he was at a birthday party and Vernon Reid happened to be at the birthday party and everybody goes to sing happy birthday. And the girl whose birthday it is says, no. Only Corey is going to sing to me. I just want Corey to sing happy birthday. And so he sings happy birthday and Vernon Reed's like, oh, like you can sing. You should come try out for my band. And he comes and tries out for the band. He's like, oh, this is great, dude. I'll let you know next week. And then like 2 months goes by and he doesn't hear anything from him. And then he calls him and he's like, hey, our singer dropped out. He's like, your singer dropped out? I thought I was auditioning to be the singer. And like, oh no, we picked this other guy. But do you want the fucking gig or not, man? Like, we got a show tonight. And he's like, yeah, sure. And then the other singer voluntarily chose not to come back. And that is how Corey Glover ended up being in Living Color. Like, they wanted another dude. And then he ended up being in the band.
That's funny.
He can wail and he looks the part too. I mean, he is a badass looking dude.
Great stage presence. I watched something, one of their, I don't know, Newport Jazz Festival or something, but it was, I mean, the guy's a beast on stage.
Well, he was into musical theater too. And so he was like a theater kid who was really into it. I think he said that he had a couple of like life-changing moments. And one of his life-changing moments was when because he grew up in New York, he was taken to see Jesus Christ Superstar when he was young. But he actually said seeing Carl Anderson play Judas Iscariot, another black guy playing Judas Iscariot who could wail and it's like kind of rock, like it sort of opened his mind up that like, oh, there's like a place for me in this. And then he actually ended up being Judas Iscariot in Jesus Christ Superstar in the mid-90s or something like that, mid to late 90s. So yeah, he's an accomplished fucking dude.
Not what you would expect from the frontman of a rock band.
Right.
And they were the anti-rock band in that sense. There's stories about them almost getting in fights with Axl Rose over like some racist shit that was in one of their songs. And, you know, you hear all the scumbag shit that they did. And Living Color was squeaky clean in that regard. You know, they had a little bit of, not infighting, but I think Muzz Skillings left the band after a few albums, was replaced by this guy, Doug Wimbish, who is a phenomenal prog bass player.
Even when Muzz Skillings left, he left on good terms. And I think it was even in the liner notes of the album that they put out that like, hey, Muzz Skillings isn't here, but we still love him. And he will come back in and like play gigs with them to this day. They're all still friends. And I do think that part of that, what you're talking about with them not being heroin addicts or trashing hotel rooms, it does go back a little bit to that, the Obama shit, where Obama was like, I am the first black president. I can't have any scandals because then it's going to be amplified a million times and it's going to reflect negatively on more than just me. It's going to be used as, well, you see, this is why we never elected one of them before type of shit. And so he's like, I had to be better than fucking George W. Bush was, the guy right before me, or the guy right before him who was getting blowjobs in the Oval Office. Like, I can't do that shit. I have to be better. It's unfair, but it's certainly a reality.
But so ultimately, you know, we've referenced Mick Jagger a few times, but as they're starting to come up in this scene, Mick Jagger was spending a lot of time in New York City working on one of his solo records. And he was actually, I think he was auditioning guitarists and some other musicians to actually play on his solo record. And that's when he first came across Living Color. and he advocated for them to be signed by Epic. They end up getting signed. They put out this album. It doesn't do a lot until MTV kind of picks up on this and just starts playing the shit out of Cult of Personality. And then the story kind of is well trodden at that point. And speaking of Cult of Personality, let's dive into that if y'all are ready to...
Oh, we're going to talk some song specifics?
Hell yeah.
I have some specific complaints, so let's fucking get into it.
In fact, 1001 just for this album.
Yeah.
All right, let's pick back up on Cult of Personality here.
I particularly appreciate when songs that make it into the mainstream play with time signatures. I just think that's always cool because there's so many B-sides that have weird things that they're doing with the timing and stuff. But when something hits the radio or hits MTV and it's like, oh, there's a bar of seven or whatever it might be, I'm like, that's really cool. Great job, band, on writing a song where you made it so catchy that you managed to sneak in something weird like that. So really appreciate that. And my other thing was that I didn't realize all these years that the opening little clip there was a Malcolm X from a Malcolm X speech. So that was one of my little deep dives.
Yeah, I think that like the riff is really snaky and cool. It kind of plays in and around the one beat, which is very cool. And honestly, like, the song's not bad. It's got a nice shreddy solo. However, listen, certain songs are kind of written based off of one phrase or one word or something like that. And that's okay. You have to be tasteful with it, though. And say what you will about the classic 1995 Seven Mary Three song Cumbersome, but at least they have the good taste to not repeat it for 21 seconds straight at the end of the song. At the end of Cumbersome was just him going, Cumbersome! 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 It would have sucked a lot more. And he really beats that phrase, the Cult of Personality, to death in this song.
How long is he going to do this for?
Is he going to say the whole thing?
Yeah, and he does.
Each syllable?
And then he just goes, I am the cult of! I am the cult of! I am the cult of! Like 11 times in a row. Come on, man.
I have to complain a little bit about the guitar solo. I know it's an epic guitar solo, but I can't stand this guitar solo. It really sounds like he's having a seizure. It is so frantic and frenetic. I don't actually like it until probably three quarters of the way through the guitar solo when it finally lands on it. That's the only part of the solo I like. And then he even stops that and does another like noise thing.
See, that's, again, this is where you and I kind of differ on this album. I wanted them to lean farther into that weird, angular, shreddy guitar stuff. I thought that was cool. I think that's probably one of the highlights of the songs. I just wish that they went deeper.
Okay.
Again, that's going to be a lot of my comments on this is, you know, just you guys fucking shred. Just shred. Go deeper.
Lean into it.
Yeah. And this song, at least the core of this song, does show off all of their abilities. It gives Corey Glover an opportunity to do some nice, good singing and get up there. I don't like the I am the cult of part, but he's wailing on that part. And, you know, Vernon Reid, that guitar riff that he's playing. It's not just kind of you know, which some of the other songs are just a little bit too simple for me like that. And then when they extend the riff into that odd time signature and you get Muzz Skillings and Vernon Reid kind of doubling each other, they are tight.
Yeah.
Absolutely
right,
precise.
Right.
There is no off time note in that. It's really impressive.
I would love to know how many times it took them to get that in the studio, or I'm assuming these guys are super pros. And if they came up in the prog and the fusion scene, what, twice?
Yeah.
You know, to right? Like do that crazy complicated synchronous yeah. thing.
I will say that as much as I do like the tones on the album, I don't particularly think that it is mixed super well. It's not terrible, but I just would have liked a little bit more darkness in those guitars and a little bit more guitar forward aspect of it. And the bass that will jump out sometimes when he's doing like slap and stuff like that. But I wanted a little bit more separation between the tones to get me a little bit like in the mixing process. I feel like they could have separated them out a little bit to make not hard panning clearly, but something that just would have made them a little bit easier to discern all of the really intricate stuff that is going on in each of these parts.
Okay, let's turn our attention to the next track, which is actually the track that follows this on the album, which is a track called I Want to Know.
I know it's not fair to them, but all I kept thinking of was the Whitney Houston song, I Wanna Know If He Loves Me. And I love that song.
I would have rather listened to that.
Yeah. And the whole time I was like, why can't I should be listening to Whitney Houston? She can wail too. That's a pretty damn good song. Listen, that, hey kids, at the beginning of the song, my note is Jesus Christ, that is both cheesy and creepy at the same time. He sounds like if Fat Albert was a child molester. And then I remembered that Bill Cosby did the voice of Fat Albert, and I was like, oh, wait, yeah.
I was going to say, what do you mean if? Jesus.
Look, I don't know if it's the worst track on the album or not. There's some contenders. It's possible. What compelled me to want to talk about this song, I don't have a lot to say about it. The egregious sequencing of putting this. So say what you want about Cult of Personality. I don't want to keep like sucking it off indefinitely, but it is a great song. When you get to the end of that song, those riffs that he's playing, I feel like you're in like Rage Against the Machine territory before they were even a thing. Which, side note, you know, Tom Morello has actually cited them as one of his major influences for even wanting to be a guitar player. So
yeah, I can totally see that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So you come out of the gates strong. The riffs at the end, it's like very Rage-like. I'm ready to run through a wall at the end of that song. And then this is what you play next. What came to mind for me is it almost sounds like it was like a song that would be on Saved by the Bell or something.
From Zack Attack?
Where it's like, this is a song by all objective measures of the criteria, but it doesn't feel like, if I were playing this song in a band, I don't know how I would do it because there's nothing memorable at all to feel anchored to.
And I think even more so than that, it's the construction of the song. And I noted that the bass is not playing the root of the chord at all.
What kind of punk rock guys are these?
Right. Seriously. Because the guitar player is playing these chords and the bass is routinely playing like the third or the fifth. So you never feel like satisfied of it hitting a chord. And it does that the whole song until I think the bridge, when it kind of gets this kind of like little poppy thing at around 140.
Turns into surf rock.
Right. And you feel something definitely change because then the bass finally like rolls into playing the chord pattern. But it's so off-putting. Even the chorus doesn't hit hard. Like what they could have done, and something that a band that comes to mind is Soul Live, which mostly instrumental, but they'll do things where they'll be playing their groove and the bass line will jump up and for half a measure play the third or the fifth, and it gives it this really cool movement. It's kind of tentative and then it resolves. This never resolves. So you constantly, you're just tense the whole time.
Yeah. My big note for this song is that just because you can build a harmony doesn't mean you should build that harmony. The harmony of the chorus is off-putting, and it's well executed. It's like he had an idea, and he wanted to do that idea, and he did that idea, and it was a bad idea. You shouldn't have done it. It was just, it's off-putting.
You and perfectly then, executed a bad idea. Congrats.
Yeah. And I think that that is maybe like the thesis for a lot of this album is you perfectly executed a bad idea.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
What's better than horribly executing bad ideas, which I'm quite familiar with.
Yeah. We are, as we all are. You talked about how this song sounds like something that would be on Saved by the Bell. And the hallmark of those songs is that they have a songwriter and they're like, we need a throwaway song. We need a song that you're going to spend a day on, and then we're going to put it in an episode of Saved by the Bell, and nobody's ever going to think about it again. That's kind of what this felt like to me. It's a little throwaway. Even the lyrics are just dumb. Talking about, it's like, ooh, girl shit. Baby, you stole my heart. I don't know what to do. It's like, shut the fuck up, man.
It really could be a Zach Attack song.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like they're that comfortable playing this.
Yeah, this was one of those ones where it felt pointless the whole time. I'm just like, why is this even on? Why is this here?
Yeah.
Why am I listening to this song? There's nothing of substance here. The lyrics are terrible. The riff is not that great. The solo, Vernon Reid, again, he's a great guitar player, but the first half of this solo is super weak. And then he kind of shreds for a second. Then he goes back into a super weak end of the solo. I'm like, you're not even using the pieces that you have. Give me a bullshit song. And then have the guitar player get some over the solo. And at least I'll be like, ah, well, he got some over the solo. That's something. This was nothing. It was nothing from beginning to end. Alan, it goes back to your, like, what does water taste like? Water tastes like nothing. Or does it taste like something? Tastes like water. This tasted like nothing. Yeah.
Just the blown opportunity. It's not like this is an album full of bangers, but they could have easily found another song that could keep the momentum going and keep you feeling like you're in it. But instead, I feel like they just squander a big opportunity on this song.
There were 10 other songs they could have put. Yeah.
10 other mediocre songs they could have put on instead of this.
And probably fall into the same trap. All right. Yeah, anyway,
Speaking of mediocre songs, let's turn our sights to the next song on our focus list, which is called Desperate People.
I think I have quite possibly the least complimentary thing to say about this particular song. That yeah at the beginning, that is 100% Sammy Hagar. That's a Hagar yeah. And I was like, oh my God, this is like the absolute worst of 80s cheese, middle of the road bullshit rock. We are deep in the Van Hagar era at this time. This is 1988. And literally the song Cabo Wabo came out in 1988, which I don't know if you guys have listened to Cabo Wabo in your lifetime.
I don't know that I have. I may have heard it in passing. Yeah.
It is shockingly bad. And I re-listened to it this week because...
Wait, are you sure it's shockingly bad?
It's shockingly bad. I wasn't expecting it to be this bad. And I've been to the Cabo Wabo restaurant in Cabo, and I was still surprised at how bad it was. Although I will say the Cabo Wabo restaurant, I went there in, I think it was like 2005, maybe 2004. And I ordered a Red Bull and vodka, and they looked at me very confused. And for the Red Bull and vodka, they brought out to me a Red Bull can and a pint glass of vodka. And
we're like, oh, there is a Red Bull and vodka.
And I was like, wow, I'm not going to remember anything tonight.
And here's your antifreeze on the side as well.
Yeah, seriously.
Some good things about this song. I thought the intro was pretty cool. I like that there was an intro that was way different than the main groove. It was a very frenetic intro. And when it came in, I thought the riff was pretty badass. The drum tones are, it's the 80s. I'll give him a pass on that. But the, I'll call it his inauthentic vocal delivery. Like he's trying to emote by just going, like, yeah. Like it feels like if he just gets guttural with it, it'll be very emotive. And it's not. There was a one that I noted at 139 where he does, yeah, only dream when you're away. And he just really digs in. It wasn't great. You say you're only dreaming your
way.
Yeah, very Hetfield. But he does a great metal scream at 345. So good on you, man. Like a very Iron Maiden metal scream that I enjoyed.
I will say that this is probably my find on the album, as much shit as I talked on that intro part being all Hagar. I do think that this song kind of captures the yin and yang of this band. Really, really talented musicians, but they kind of just put together lame songs. This song, I feel like at least the talented musician part kind of jumped out a little bit, and the lame song didn't sink it entirely. It's taken on water, don't get me wrong. It's not going to make it to shore, but it didn't sink like a stone like some of the other ones did. You know, one thing that I do find to be interesting about this album, and I don't know how true this is in terms of the actual credits, but almost every other song on the album is written by Vernon Reid. Corey Glover's got a couple of credits in there, but the one song that they all wrote was Cult of Personality. So like the money for that one got split equally four ways, which if that was not actually the case, I'm sure Ooh. That Vernon Reid's kicking himself on that one, being like, you know, honestly, you just name checked a couple of historical figures and said Cult of Personality 27 times. I wrote the fucking riff, man. Come on. Like.
You just opened Dictators on Wikipedia right. And just started reading fucking names. And think of a few names who would make the list now.
Oh, there's some Cult of Personality going on in 2024? What are you talking about?
Never.
Just a tiny bit.
No cults. I will say at least one politician these days is giving me a funny vibe.
Let's do it. Let's dance. Funny vibe. So why you wanna give me that funny vibe? Yo, taxi.
Yeah, where you going?
Yo, we going to Brooklyn, chief.
Me not going to.
Yo, man, hold up, man. Your yellow cab. Yeah, man. I tell you to go, man. We going to Brooklyn, man.
Yeah, but me said me not going
to Brooklyn. Yo, man, what I'm saying, man. I'm just take down your number and everything, man. Yo, man, I'm gonna just stay in the cab, man.
No, get out of
here.
Exploitate,
woman not a sister's woman ain't toys, and I would never take, even when I see a shake. So why
never raised my hands, it's in self-defense. But just because my shirt has an African fringe, you think I wanna hurt jerks?
No, I'm not gonna harm you.
Unless you're offended by what I say. And I don't mean to harm you that way. Learn the truth. Give me that funny vibe.
Hey, Jeff, we got some non-believers out there.
Yeah, Flav, I'm tired of them dissing brothers in the PE out there. We got to do something about this, you know what I'm saying?
This song fucking sucks. I get where they're coming from. Every time that there is words happening, this song sucks. And every time that there's not words happening, I'm like, this song's actually pretty good.
Sounds like a Rush song a little bit.
Listen, I 100% get where they're coming from. I think that in modern parlance, they would be talking about microaggressions of, I'm walking down the street and you're looking at me like I'm going to beat you or rob you or rape you. And like, fuck you. I'm trying not to hate you, but you're like making me uncomfortable by how uncomfortable you are just by me existing. I get the message. Completely underusing Chuck D on this one, which, I mean, you got fucking Chuck D on your track and that's what you use him for. I think quite possibly my favorite liner note credit is that Flavor Flav gets credit for social commentary on this track. What the fuck, man?
What?
Isn't that what we're doing here? A little social commentary? You know, where's our
credit?
Hey,
no. Yeah.
There's a point in this song. He says, I'm not going to beat you. And then there's just this background vocal that just goes, beat you. It's, what was the decision there? What was it like? Oh, no, you need to really hammer this home that you are not going to beat this person. And the way you're going to do that is by singing the word beat for a very long time.
If it's supposed to be a little tongue-in-cheek, which is kind of what I got, like I didn't really think that this was super serious, but at the same time, Tom, like you're saying, the lyrical content is pretty on point and serious for what they were likely experiencing.
Chuck D does not do tongue-in-cheek. Chuck D is a fucking, right. I'm going to shout at you right. about the ills of society kind of guy.
There are parts where things happen and it feels good. I got some King Crimson vibes from this song, musically speaking, but it was just a little hard for me to get my arms around.
Arms around. What the fuck? I could not get past that part that you're talking about. They do it again in the second verse. I think he's like, I'm not going to harm you. Harm you. It's like, I get it, Corey. You can sing. But you're not saving this fucking song. So just give up.
That right? amount of over-singing is going to save this song.
Less is more, guys.
All right. Let's turn it to the final song that we're going to talk about today, which was also, it was the cute little like follow-up single that they probably thought was going to take off because the first one did. That is a song called Glamour Boys.
Hey man, this song left me feeling hot, hot, hot. I mean, this is really, really corny.
What? This is the Mick Jagger produced song too. So I was trying to identify where Mick Jagger's voice is on this song, because he sings backups on this song. And I think that Mick Jagger is in there on the "I'm fierce," which is the worst fucking seconds of the album by a landslide. That is the cheesiest goddamn thing I've ever heard in my life. They gang vocal on I'm fierce.
Yeah. Okay.
If we all come in on this part, like we're fierce, people are going to remember it. It's going to become a catchphrase.
Yeah, seriously.
It winds up becoming a catchphrase 20 years later. What was it?
For like RuPaul's Drag Race or something, right? Like,
I will admit that I used to watch, there was a couple of seasons where I watched Project Runway in the late 2000s, and there was a designer named Christian Soriano, I think. But his big thing was this is fierce. And everything was like vocal fry, fierce. And they made fun of it on SNL. So every time they said that, I giggled thinking that this is the least cool phrase nowadays, or at least to sound tough or like you're not a glamour boy.
So I do wonder if he is talking about maybe not fully trans people, but certainly people who are like men who are dressing as women. Because the opening line is the glamour boys swear they are a diva. And a diva is a woman. And so I'm wondering if that's what he's talking about. Granted, they're in the club scene in New York.
It might have been the late 80s. There was a documentary called Paris is Burning, which traveled with the underground trans scene of all the different minorities in New York. And to see when this song and this album came out, that's really interesting. When I first heard it, I was thinking more just like playboys who are rich and have all the cash and everything. But you're right, that opening line definitely calls into question my understanding of the song.
But then it's like, I ain't no trans diva, I'm fierce. Right. Like, you're not exactly making the case here, buddy.
I'm not gonna say I like this song, but it's living in my head rent free a little bit.
You know what? My ears perked up with this one. I will give you that.
There's a band, I don't know how familiar people are with a band called String Cheese Incident. Have you ever heard of them, Adam? I know you're familiar, Tom.
Christ. A little bit. Were they a jam band from the 90s?
God. Yeah, late 90s, 2000s. They still play, but...
Okay.
But this is the kind of shit they do, and it's pretty... I'm cool with that genre of music. I've been to several String Cheese shows and had a great time. But they're a bunch of white guys trying to play like islandy jam music, and you can tell that they're just a bunch of white guys from Colorado. And one of the only notes I had was, this is what String Cheese might sound like if they were actually like decent and had some sense of musicality.
Alan, I think that the low point of my concert going career was I was at a festival and String Cheese Incident were closing it. And I'm standing on this field. I've been there all day and I'm tired. And they are playing Superstition with a guy on mandolin also playing, and they're like, very superstitious. The writing is on the wall. And I was like, I'm fucking leaving. I'm not doing this anymore. I gotta get out of here. This is terrible. And so, yes, this is like the String Cheese version of Calypso music, and none of these things are compliments at all. My first note for this song is this a fucking joke? That was my first note. This song is so bad. And then that was even before I found out that it was Mick Jagger. That was Mick fucking Jagger. This is what you do with Mick Jagger. Being like, I'll sing backup on your album. Fantastic. Where do you want me? Well, we got this weird song. It's kind of Calypso. It's about how we're not those glamour divas. We're fierce. Okay. So like, let's get that out there right now.
To me, this song was sort of like the final boss of the genre shifting, where it's like...
final boss you have to try to shoot your way through.
You're rolling the dice here, and this is getting into some sketchy territory. Still catchy, though, and I'm still noodling on it, so I won't lie.
I feel sorry for you, Alan. I really do.
Only for that?
Well, mostly for this, honestly. If it's living rent-free in your house, you might want to write an open letter to that landlord.
Padlock the doors.
I think we've mused enough on this album, certainly more than it's probably worth. But let us render our very suspenseful verdicts that I think are coming on whether or not you should actually listen to this album before you die. Let's turn it over to you, Tom.
there is no surprise in my vote. I wanted to like the album. I really did. And it's a bunch of really talented musicians playing really mediocre songs, which is more disappointing than shitty musicians playing mediocre songs or even shitty musicians playing shitty songs. There was potential, didn't live up to it. Again, I think that all of the individual guys in the band seem like, number one, great players, and number two, they really have their shit together. And so I have a lot of respect for them, but I don't need to listen to this album, and neither do you.
Adam.
All right. So I don't hate this album. I know a lot of people out there probably really, really like this album. But hey, I really like Hoobastank, but they don't deserve to be on the list. And neither does this album. So all the right ingredients, but they miss the mark. So it's a no for me.
Adam, we're going to have to coin the Hoobastank rule from here on out. Adam's invoking the Hoobastank protocols of 2024.
It's a good card to pull when times get tough. I also think it's a no. And I will say, I actually feel like I'm going a little bit against some of my core values when it comes to this stuff. I sort of am working on the premise that you wouldn't have heard Cult of Personality before. However, well, and the I do think it is a somewhat historical, significant artifact almost. But I think the problem for me is that that's just not enough because I don't think it's good enough really to like hold that weight. I think them being able to break through was noteworthy and I think it was an accomplishment, but I don't think they were the band that should have been ushered into this. I don't think the music was really fit for pop sensibilities. And so I think it's a no for me as well. So Vernon and company, as you sit on your double platinum awards and cry yourself to sleep at night, knowing that we did not vote for you, but it's okay because I think you're doing just fine.
Three mid-40s white guys thought your album was just kind of okay. I will await the obituary about your suicide soon.
All right. Let's turn it over to one of my favorite parts of this here show, which is the missives that you folks will send us from time to time. What do we got in the old mailbag today, Adam?
Yes, so Rob has sent over the mailbag to me. I'm honored to be able to dig my hand in and pull out a couple notes. So our first one is from Paul from the UK. And Paul writes, "Stop pissing on my favorite albums, except Nena Cherry," which he allowed. First, it was Soft Cell, one of my favorites. In its defense, it was a dark time during Thatcher's early rule, and this album was much needed to brighten things up, sex, dwarves, and all. I thought you'd all see how influential Gary Numan was, which I did. Thank you. This is Adam. I did recognize that. Way to go, Paul. Paul goes on, "You mentioned Nine Inch Nails, and he definitely also inspired Marilyn Manson. Anyway, keep up the great work. You're all absolutely brilliant, but sometimes wrong with your final verdicts." I'll give you that, Paul. All right.
More than sometimes wrong.
Right.
Yeah, he's half right. Yeah.
Next up, we have a note from Clint from Utah. He writes, "Gentlemen and Tom."
Oh, nice.
First
nice.
Off, Clint. Clint, I love you.
He can read a room. I get it.
Clint goes on, "I found your podcast last year while on a long work road trip. I was charmed by the banter immediately and listened to 4 or 5 episodes on that drive. Since then, you've been my go-to for commuting, and I excitedly look forward to a new episode each week. I just finished this week's episode on Gary Numan and tend to agree with Tom." Die, bastard. Mm-hmm. I respect...
This guy clearly doesn't know what he's talking about.
"I respect but never listen to Numan. I also hope Tom doesn't take offense at my greeting. It's just that I see myself reflected in his opinions often, and I know how I feel about myself, gentleman-wise. Yeah, yeah. The reason I'm writing is that I could not have been happier when the Albinator landed on Songs of Leonard Cohen. Cohen's first 4 albums are probably all in my top 20 albums of all time, even though the rest of his later work drops precipitously off a cliff on the list. Anyway, cheers, gents. Thanks for the awesome content."
All right.
Thank you, Clint.
Yeah. I do wonder how many hours of road tripping it took you to finally like be able to stomach this.
That is a long ass road trip. Yeah. All right. And finally, listener Ray from Parts Unknown writes in, thanks for another great episode. We Leonard Cohen stans cringed at the early records with their off-key, uninspired vocals over monotonous finger-picking guitar. But inexorably, we were drawn to the lyrics with their mysterious, portentous phrases. I need a dictionary for this email. I don't know what inexorably or portentous means, but I love it. And even so, we admit that the cover versions are far superior. Jeff Buckley's Hallelujah, Johnny Cash's Bird on a Wire, and many more. It seems like something similar happened for all of you, given the surprising 5-0 yes vote. P.S. I'm loving the 90s song tournament. I'm here for the other decades, especially 60s and 70s, boomer that I am. I could make some recommendations for those brackets. Beyond 2000, I'm out of my element. Cheers and boosh. Sadly, I think I'm probably out of my element for anything post-2000
yeah.
as well.
I only know one that's going to make that list, and it's Alan just putting Call Me Maybe for every one of his choices.
Dude, I know how to stack the deck. Come on.
Well, we appreciate your emails, everybody. And if you've got something to say, if we got it right, if we got it wrong, or if you just want to throw some shade at us or throw some love at us, drop us an email at 1001albumcomplaints@gmail.com, and we'll be sure to read your missive on the air. Alan, back to you.
Well, I'm just going to boomerang it right back around, well, I guess, to Tom to dust off the Albinator. It looks like Tom's got like 8 beer cans sitting on top of it, so...
Dude, don't judge the Albinator, okay? It can feel your scorn, all right?
I'm judging you. I'm not judging the Albinator.
Just because you did a dry January, I all of a sudden act all superior, all right?
Oh, no, I followed up with a tsunami February, so I'm making up for lost time here.
Fair enough. All right, so I got the Albinator here. It has been headbanging. It's long dreads in the corner. It's got its multicolored neon hued spandex on, and it is going to bust out an album. So without any further ado, drum roll please, we will be listening to the album is Goodbye Yellow Brick Road by Elton John.
Nice.
It's going to be a little bit of a tonal shift.
I was wondering when we're going to get to some John. That's the first, I think, right?
I think that is the first Elton John. I personally am really excited to talk copious amounts of shit on Bernie Taupin and his inability to write more than one good line per song.
Wait, you're going to talk shit on something? That's out of character.
I mean, like an extra special amount of shit, even for me. I have a long history of raging against Bernie Taupin and his unnecessary, stupid lyrics, and then his ability to write one great line. Hold me closer, tiny dancer. Count the headlights on the highway. That's a good line. Lay me down in sheets of linen. I had a busy day today. Those two lines suck. And that's like his most famous fucking song.
Touche.
Yeah.
For someone who doesn't dig it, you sure got a lot of these lines banked, ready to go.
Oh, dude, you know the entire premise of this show is we have to be able to contextually talk shit. You can't just say, I don't like his lyrics. You got to be able to bust out 5 or 6. Goodbye, Yellow Brick Road, where the dogs of society howl. You can't plant me in your penthouse. I'm going back to my plow. What the fuck are you talking about, Bernie? We're not going to waste the gold.
All right, okay? Save the gold, baby. Yeah. Save the gold.
Can't give away free content.
Except for we do every week.
Except we do.
Because we love you.
All right. Sounds like we got a great week in store, and we'll be able to wash our hands of this week's arduous task. With that, I have been Alan.
I've been Tom.
And I'm Adam.
Boosh.
No, I'm not going to boosh you.
Boosh.